Elder Exchange. If you have been with us before, you know that the Elder Exchange is a monthly academic discussion of issues concerning faith and life. And it is always our pleasure to gather each month for this purpose. Our topic tonight on migrants, refugees, and immigrants is certainly a timely one. It is also a complex one, and sometimes a contentious one. In the biography, Mr. Ressler says that he will stimulate our thinking, reframe the conversation, unpack the issues, and perhaps even confuse further some of the issues. So I think we're in for a treat. This is exactly what we value about the Elder Exchange, that we can provide an open and honest, creative, Christ-centered conversation about these types of things. So we are so glad that we have the opportunity to do that. And I always like to give a little shout out to Roman Miller and Richard Bowman and express our appreciation to them for arranging these evenings and the excellent work that they do pulling it all together. So thank you, Roman and Richard. We'd like to begin this evening in prayer, so please join me in prayer. God of abundant grace, we gather this evening grateful for an opportunity to come together, for the simple joy of learning from one another and listening to one another. Open our minds and hearts tonight to new ways of seeing your world and the people who inhabit it. While any number of crises cause your people to be displaced and constantly moving, we also know that your love for us is ever present. We pray that through our discussion tonight, we might come to a greater understanding of you. Help us to know just how deep and wide your love extends around this world. We pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you, Betsy. On behalf of Richard Bowman, myself, we also want to welcome you this evening. Appreciate the time and effort that you're spending to come out and to listen and learn tonight. Might just make a point or comment about the flyer that you received when you came in. So on the one side, we have our program for this evening, and you'll see a synopsis of the presentation and the names of the responders, etc. Also want to point out again our logo, the woven tapestry rope-like thing you see at the corner, and it's representing an exchange, an interweaving of young and old, and some really old, interchanging and sharing ideas. And so that's what we want to do in Elder Exchange. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, and just to make you aware of what's going to happen after our speaker finishes his presentation, we have two responders. They will share their views on what was shared tonight or some comments about a portion of it, and then we have a time for question and answers from you all. So think about the questions that you might want to ask, and you'll have an opportunity to direct those to the speaker and or to either of the responders. Everett Ressler is well known to some of you and maybe not so well known to the rest of you. One of his distinctives, I suppose, is that he had the opportunity to marry Don Augsburger's daughter. And that kind of sets him apart from everybody else in this room. And so we're delighted to have Everett here. Everett did go to school in addition to marrying Don's daughter. Not quite sure when that happened in his life, but went to EMC, and I was surprised. I didn't know he majored in biology, but then he went far afield. But anyway, went to JMU, master's in educational psychology, did graduate work at the University of Delaware, and then plunged fully into a lot of international kinds of issues. He first was under the auspices of MCC and the Eastern Board, and spent 40 years looking at emergency kinds of issues in 7 countries especially, and you're going to hear a lot about that tonight. What he saw, what he learned, what are some of the underlying issues behind all of that. During that time, he worked for UNICEF, he worked for various other NGOs, and you can see on the speaker biography of what you have in handed to you this evening, some other things about him. I should have had him bring a piece of sculpture, which apparently he does. I haven't seen that, but I didn't ask him to do that. So without further ado, let's welcome Everett to the podium, and let's...
Elaine Zook-Barge went to Arizona on an MCC learning tour about migration and immigration. And I just want to tell you, I brought this with me. This came from an artist in Tucson. And every Tuesday, he takes a cross, bigger one than this, about this big, and he goes into the desert with about 10 people, and he takes 3 crosses. And each one with a bag of cement, they plant the cross at a spot with GPS locators that is where an immigrant died in the desert to commemorate the person. In another place south, if you go down to the border, there's a process that's been going on for 17 years. Started by a Presbyterian worker there, and still goes on, and every Tuesday for 17 years, rain or shine, whether anybody's there or not, he and usually a group take their own set of crosses, another one, 320 of them, and they put them in a children's wagon, and they go down to the street along into the entrance of the U.S., and they take these crosses, and each one has the name of someone who died. Maria Garcia, May, approximately May such and such a date. And then the process is you go in a kind of a circle, and each person picks up 3 crosses and walks to a crack in the sidewalk and says, Maria Garcia. And everyone says, presente. Presente is a word used to honor, to recognize. And then you put the cross on the crack in the sidewalk, and the next person does it. Every year, every Tuesday, you know, this is the process. Because these people believe in something else than about immigration law and border security. They have a different set of values, a different way of looking at it. Well, that's what we want to talk about tonight a little bit. This photo I put on just as a reminder that migration is natural, normal. And the birds do it, and the animals do it, and people do it all the time. So just to keep that as a kind of beginning. I want to say, first of all, thanks to Rome and the team for inviting me here. I'm not sure I have anything to offer at all of this, but because I'm in the process, like you, of trying to figure this out. What is the right thing to do? What is the position we should hold? Are we holding it? Are we doing the right thing? So that's the kind of orientation I start with. For me, the history of this goes back to about a year ago in Harrisonburg here, just about a stone's throw from here. I organized a meeting at the house of people who studied separated children separated from their parents in wars and refugee situations. And we were looking at honoring their contributions and looking at this field. And in that meeting, we also invited, as a second meeting, people who work on the migrant issues, children's issues, all from different parts of the U.S. And we sat there for a couple days listening to the stories of lawyers and social workers and advocates and concerned people about the treatment of unaccompanied children, about children and migrants. Remember that my work has all been international for 40 years, so my focus has not been on the U.S. at all. But for me and all the people who came to this meeting who were international, and they came from faraway places, Norway and France and Papua New Guinea and other places, they were shocked. I was shocked. And I said, in the U.S.? I just can't believe it. So anyway, it started a process of exploration for me. So after that meeting, I began to write some papers to try to say, do you really mean this? And get verification of what I had heard. And so then in September, Elaine Zuckerbarge and I went to Texas, and we interviewed people from Houston down to San Antonio and down to Brownsville and across the border to listen, to understand. And then last, as I said, I mentioned a couple weeks ago, Vernon and Elaine and I went to Arizona. And in this trip was even, I must say, MCC has done just a fabulous job at putting together this learning tour. It just deserves every support, and if you have any chance to do it, it's just, you will be shocked at what you learn. And it gives a chance on this tour to go across into Mexico and talk with people who are trying to get into the States, who want to be, who are migrants and who are seeking asylum, and a chance to talk with the people in the shelter who was helping them, keeping them from being kidnapped. And it was a chance to talk with the people on the border guard. You had meetings and listened to the border guard talk about their work and their perspective. And then the people who were commemorating the death and saying, this isn't right. And we then went on to Tucson, and we went to Florence, Arizona, a city that is 100% prisons. If you drive down the road, there's a prison on the left and a prison on the right, and a prison on the left and a prison on the right. 20,000 maybe held in prisons there. What? I said, I've never seen anything like this. I heard about it. I've read about things in Russia, gulags and other things, but I never knew we had a prison city in our own country. And that's what it is. But we had the chance to go and visit an ICE center, the Immigration Services Center there. And it's probably the nicest one in the U.S. And they have 5 such centers, but there are about 200 centers around the rest of it. And the 200 are private, for-profit detention centers. The staff were fantastic. The deputy warden gave us time and sat with us in the conference room. We asked him difficult questions. He gave us a tour of the detention center. And we looked at the beginnings, or you might say the best example, the rosy example that they're showing us of a system of detention. So anyway, we went on and we went to the courts and we sat and we listened as they brought in people in handcuffs and chains as they admitted to crossing the border and that this was illegal and they were therefore criminalized for this activity. And we saw that process. And we went to the shelters where they they are sometimes, if they went through this process where churches and MCC and other people have actually provided assistance as they pass through. And we talked with people who had been in detention and come out of this thing. And we talked about people who were seeking help. We talked with artists, as I told you, this man, who was so inspiring, not from a religious point of view. And this is important, because the issue about value of life and respect and dignity and rights is not unique, isn't held solely by religious people. In fact, it is shocking to me that the advocates, the strongest voice for people, the migrants, is not the religious community, it's the lawyers now. The lawyers are defending them on the basis of rights. But underneath, more quietly, is a mass of religious affiliations. Catholics and Presbyterians seem to be carrying the weight down on the border. So it's not one denomination, it's not one, but it's people of faith who say something isn't right. We just don't accept this. And they, one thing that's different is that they look at the individual as an individual. The words that we heard over and over is, we're all God's people. So they refuse, they see the world through this different lens, not as illegals or job stealers and so forth. They see them from a different way. So anyway, core values. So what's happening in this immigration thing? Well, let's say it's a very logical thing. It's completely understandable that this, I think the six questions that the system is asking, that is, all, you know, many people all over the U.S. is asking, and in every country, this is not unique. This is not unique. Every country is going through the same questions. And that's who and why are people seeking entry? How many migrants should be permitted? Who should be permitted or denied, and on what grounds? What should happen to those who enter by going around formal systems? What legitimate deterrence might be used to counter irregular entry? How should asylum seekers, the undocumented, the people with criminal records be treated? At the heart of the immigration, I think, are these six questions that people are dealing with. Now, we're not going to try to answer those tonight. In fact, what I think that the question we ask over and over is, okay, what we're going to do is look at the question, what beliefs should I hold with regard to immigration? What values, what beliefs? And secondly, what should I do? We asked that question wherever we went and on our trips. And we said, what do you think we should do in Harrisonburg? And we'll come back to that a little bit later. I conclude, Vernon may have much better insights than I do from his more studied experience, but I conclude when I thought about this for tonight, that there's one thing that I think is important, and that we should think about the fact that in those questions, everyone includes an ethical, moral component. And that issue, I don't believe, is being considered, or is certainly not talked about. It's certainly not evident enough. And if we are to think about this immigration migration question, my position, my suggestion is that it will help us if we think of saying, okay, whatever of those questions exist, the question that we would ask as people of faith is to say, what's the ethics of this? And in Romans, words to me on this, what would Jesus say about this? So what are the ethics behind these different things? And that's the contribution. We may not be able to answer the question, how many people is the right amount to be allowed to enter into the U.S.? But we can say, and should be saying, what we think the ethics are behind that, the considerations that should be taken into account. In my view, When I thought about it, I think that there's a dilemma that's going on. That is, the tension in the debate about immigration is between those who believe that the ends justify the means. And so the opposite position is to say, no, the goal may be legitimate. Managing immigration may be a legitimate national policy function. But there is an ethical consideration that has to be taken into account in the actions and the consequences of that sort of thing. It's like this, in a sense, to say that maybe the goal is to reduce immigration, reduce the unlawful immigration at any cost. And what the opposite position would be, trying to manage immigration is legitimate, but there is an ethical consideration which you must be held accountable for, which you should include and be held accountable for. To me, it's really fundamental, and it's to me what people of faith have to offer in particular. Why? Because to me, the more I thought about it, you know, the questions are legitimate, the questions are right for governments to think about. But any action, which I would call utilitarian, action like that, that doesn't include the moral consideration, ends with what I call, you know, the great violations, the shocking of our conscience. That is, that's what happened with World War II, for example, when the objectives that the governments were thinking of, in the end, did such horrible things to achieve it, so violated the norms, the beliefs that we hold as humans and as Christians, that in the end, it came to naught. It did so much destruction. Well, I would say the same thing, that is, that the ethical is always the ballast that we should be advocating for utilitarian things. Our ethics is rooted in large part in, of course, our religious beliefs, and also our broader beliefs that religious beliefs informs about rights and the humanity of all and how people should be treated. Does this mean, then, that the people who are acting in certain ways today are necessarily unethical? And I would say, well, it's a little bit more tricky than that. Can we say that the religious, because you hold a belief from a religious point of view, that you are necessarily moral or ethical? I don't think history shows that at all. So the problem is, it's not an easy one, because people of faith and people with good intent, sometimes who have done very bad things, have also done very good things. And some people who of faith and ethics and beliefs have done very bad things. And we can think over history of some of the church's actions and some of faith leaders. And all one has to do today is listen to the radio and watch certain TV programs. And you said, how does this fit with a concept or with the principles of love and brotherhood and other ideas we have of what Christianity and what Jesus would say? How does that fit? So, in other words, we need to look more carefully at, you know, what is ethical? What does that mean? How are we going to get there? What will help us? One, of course, is to look again at the teachings of Jesus and certainly on our tour, wherever we went, people talked about that. They talked about the fact that people have been migrants throughout the Bible. The Bible has many descriptions, including, of course, Mary and Joseph. So now, of course, if they went to the Egyptian border as they did, so the story is, they would get a wall, and somebody would say to them, "You're illegal. And, you know, why have you come here? And we're going to separate you from your child and separate the two of you and put you in detention." That would be today's story. That was not what happened then. So, and of course, you know, I want to talk, just mention one more about the problem we have as faith as believers, and the fact that our history shows that we have a bad record in some regards. We've done tremendous good, but we always have to remember that in Nazi Germany, the churches supported the Nazis to large extent, more than the opposite. And if I have in my library, I found a sermon from 1862 by a then very famous religious leader here in the States who argued that slavery was God ordained by God. And he did it on some of the same logic we hear today. One is that we white landholders were chosen by God. And if you take away the slaves, our labor force, we will not survive. And therefore, it's God ordained that they should exist. And secondly, that the people are inferior to us. They can't function without our support as free persons. So those arguments, sometimes you hear examples of that in the discussions of, so this is to say, we can't rest simply on our laurels without challenging ourselves about what ethics means, what Jesus might have meant when he talks about his things. Now, what I was going to do is to show you something that you will not get into detail, but something I find very helpful. You know, I'm sure you know this, maybe he spoke to you before, but William Hawk, at James Madison, who used to lead the philosophy department at EMU, and then he headed the philosophy and religion department at JMU, and the thing that he has done is to work with a team, and they have come up with something called 8 questions to evaluate ethical dimensions of a situation. And it's a little tool. And in fact, all the students at JMU get it, and the administration have it in their offices, and I have a little card also, wherever it is here, that has these 8 questions. And to me, it applies very much. It's a useful tool for looking at immigration. And the questions, we won't deal with it long, but let's just go through it. He suggests, and I think this framework suggests, is it ethical? Is it fair? Is the action just and equitable? And does it balance interests, outcomes? Does the action achieve the best short and long-term outcomes? Responsibilities, what duties and obligations apply? Character, does the action help us become our ideal? You know, many people on our trips ask the question, is this what we want America to be? Putting people in detention and separating children and all sorts of these things? That's the kind of question it applies. Does the action show respect for human freedom and autonomy and consent? Does the action demonstrate care for all? Do the authorities, government, law, God, expect? What do they expect? Rights. What rights, if any, innate, legal, social, apply? Now, before we went on this trip, I called Bill, and I said, go over this framework with me. Does it apply to immigration? And he went over these points, and we talked about it. So I would just say, in your thinking about your own position, and that's where maybe we should start. Remember to try to dig behind this and see what really is ethical. That is, what the basis of your beliefs are. Maybe we should begin with a little self-examination. And that is, to me, what I was thinking for myself when I went on this trip, and what I think, is that we as people of faith, and other people, any people who are concerned with the value of life and rights and freedoms and so forth, should maybe do a little self-examination. We need to look at, what are our beliefs? Where do they come from? What do we really think about these other people? The reason for that is this. I thought of 3 or 4 issues why this is important. First of all, we as mortals, as humans, tend to really think about an issue, and then we fix a conclusion. And we fix it as if it's an immutable fact. And we take it so far as we are known by these things, by others, and people will take it to extremes. That is to say, it's part of this is that we weave a logic around the belief. This is what is commonly said, that we're not very good at making our beliefs based on evidence. We tend to make our beliefs and justify whatever belief we have. I'm talking about the humans in general and what we see here in the U.S. with regard to immigration. You can bring forward all sorts of evidence, one thing or another, and you're unlikely to change a person who has a particular belief. It's a warning sign. We need to look inside a little deeper. And we can't actually understand. We're not very good at trying to figure out how you can get diametrically opposed opinions from the same source. So two people who are now, let's say, on different sides of the immigration issue, taking quite a bit, may all be using the same scriptures. And all you have to do is listen to the TV and say, it's interesting. Same source, quite different opinions. So this is just to say we need to examine ourselves more critically. There's another part of this thing that we do, I would say, and that's we have trouble dealing with complexity. Immigration is really complex, and all these different types of immigrants and all the rest. So what we tend to do as humans is we depend on generalizations. And these generalizations are in almost all cases false, or partly false. And in the past in immigration, remember that it was the Jews who were the problem, that the Irish were a problem, that Chinese people, workers, were a problem, that people from Africa are the ones who caused the troubles, that slavery was ordained, that people judged were in fear. Oh, this is really interesting, and we'll get into this just in a moment, but actually, those beliefs all have consequences, and some of those beliefs led in the U.S., as you will remember from your history, the inferior nature of people around us led to the castration of people in 20 or 30 states, 7,000 just in South Carolina. They all came from some construct in the mind that people thought they were doing the right thing, not bad things. So anyway, there are many such generalizations. This is just to say, be careful of your generalizations. Look at them, examine them, be open to see if it's correct. One of the things that I think is notable, is that VMRC would have a forum like this and be open about it. And that it would say, what is the right thing? That shows an openness to me that is the kind of spirit we need to have both personally and as groups and as other citizens. My personal experience, just to mention a few of that, Roman mentioned that I've had the privilege of living overseas for many years and working in many countries and traveling in many more. And many times I've crossed the border. And I actually have been an economic migrant as well. And so I understand a little bit. I remember the time in India when I was traveling so much I just forgot to get a visa. And I arrived at the airport, and they took me to a little room on the side, and they said, we're going to deport you on the next plane back. And I said, oh. So I called, in this case, the Indian ministry, which had invited me. I was a guest for that at the Indian government, and they came and rescued me. But I understood for a moment about visas, entry, and deportation. That was personally. So As a humanitarian, I have worked, that's how I would describe my work, somebody caring about people who are in the most acute circumstances. And I've seen and worked with these people called different names, internally displaced, migrants, refugees, and so forth. And the experiences, I've had the opportunity to listen and talk with them in many situations. And just to name a few, I saw in Ethiopia when we first left Harrisonburg, was able to talk about the people who fled famine conditions and were in famine camps and starving. I helped in the case of Cambodia, that crisis, when people were flooding across the border into Thailand, starving because of the Pol Pot regime. I've been to South Sudan and Beirut and Lebanon and many of these situations. I studied things like the Irish potato famine, and the Bengal famine, the Russian Revolution, World War I, and so forth. And why do I mention these things? To say one simple thing, that flight is a normal, adaptive human behavior. And in all my experiences, around the world, I've never seen anything other than that. Of course, in the population come dancers and preachers and singers and crooks. You know, they're all there. That's the way it is. But to me, it's important that we start in our immigration, our thinking about migration. We start from that premise that the people that are moving to take care of your family is normal and it's adaptive. You could even say it's noble. What more noble can you see than a father and a mother risking their lives for the education of their children or for the betterment of their children? So anyway, to me, that's a kind of beginning. Now, why would I raise that here, such an obvious issue? Well, one reason is because if you listen to the airways and you listen to the politicians, that's not the picture you get. They're criminals, rapists, robbers, and all sorts of things. We might have a different point of view. It might influence what we think about immigration. I was going to show you, I don't know if we have the time here, maybe we don't. I was going to show you, maybe we shouldn't because we're going to run out of time. I can see it's 10 after already. I was going to show you a video of George Bush and Ronald Reagan in their campaign. And what did they say then? This was back, you know, some years ago when they were campaigning. And the questions were raised, what about these immigrants? And what about them coming into the schools? And what did Bush and Reagan say? These are good people. We have to find a way to deal with this immigration issue without building walls. That's the word he used. And they said, because they're good people. That's how far we have moved from then to now in our thinking. I wish you could see that, but I don't think there's enough time. If we had time, I would also read you what George Washington said, that he hoped that this was a country where people from other countries could come, and it was eloquently said. So the questions for me that come from that is this kind of soul-searching questions. What is our assumptions, our descriptions of the people that we see on the news and that we see on the streets and we see coming to our country? Do we see them as caring fathers and good people, or do we see them as criminals and freeloaders? I won't go further on that. My fourth assumption in this thing is that managing immigration is recognized as a legitimate government function. But the rationale for what is done, the actions taken, and the consequences rightly deserve ethical scrutiny. And why do we say that? I mean, it is a real question that they deal with, they have to deal with. Should we leave the borders open? Should we completely close them, like North Korea? Or should we have something in the middle? That's a hard one. Excuse me. Now, let's just look at a little bit of the history. Does history help us in this regard with the U.S.? And we identified, you know, those nice statements by George Washington, for example. Let me say that when you go back in history, it's a little bit shocking. Nativism, a term we hear now, I heard it on NPR just recently, was a, and it's frequently discussed now with regard to some of our own politicians, was coined in the 1840s. And it was coined because of some a person or two who believed that the early English settlers should be defended against the German immigrants in particular, German and Irish. And they used a term called Nordicism because it really probably, they just made it up, maybe there's another word that would have been more appropriate for Germans rather than Nordics, but in any case it was called scientific racism, American scientific racism. And guess what the slogan was from that period? America first. It's stopping immigration was suggested as a matter of life and death for America. Arguments were borrowed from two books, The Passing of the Great Race, 1919, and The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, 1920. Hitler wrote to the author of that last book, saying, no, to the first book, The Passing of the Great Race, Hitler wrote and said, your book is a Bible to me. So if you want to know the consequences of that philosophy, that's where we came. In fact, at the Nuremberg trials, the Germans tried to defend themselves saying, the ideas...
Thank you very much.
Saying the ideas for what Hitler did came from the U.S. We just implemented them more. So anyway, that's just to challenge a little bit any romantic notions of where we came from. And these things still have roots. So a couple other points. U.S. didn't begin restricting immigration until 1880s. And then even then, legal immigration wasn't considered. In 82, the Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, placing a 10-year moratorium on the immigration of Chinese laborers. In 1885, when the Statue of Liberty was established, inviting the world's tired and poor, its wretched refuse, while in the same year, Congress passed the Alien Contract Law, forbidding the importation of foreign workers. In 1883 or so, started the period called positive eugenics, and this came from an interpretation of Darwin. And the idea was, we can control our purity by genetics. This seemed like a most logical conclusion. And for example, I'll read one section here from the Saturday Evening Post, which warned, this is in 1921, which warned readers of the grave immigration problem, threatening to bring about racial degeneration, which could be mitigated by scientific advances in genetics, such that, quote, Americans need never join the lowly ranks of the Mongolian races. That was the public mindset at that time. And you'll remember that during the Great Depression, 2 million people of Mexican descent were repatriated, were forced to go back to Mexico, and then, of course, the Japanese. So why mention these things? Not to categorize. It's to remind us that the seeds of that poison lay dormant in the ground all the time, waiting for a fertile opportunity to bubble up. And that says I'm supposed to stop talking. So I'll take 5 minutes. Yeah, Roman, is that okay? So in any case, Now, let me show you real quickly here a couple facts. Oops. So globally, what are we talking about? Migrant population, 258 million. That's people living in a country other than their own. Labor migrants, 150 million people working, going across borders to work. International students, 4.8 million. Forced displacement at the end of 2017, 68 million. Irregular migrants, people who don't have papers proper, 50 million. Refugees, 25 million. So first of all, we have to accept that what we should see this as somehow a global problem, not just a US problem, that's for sure. In the US, this is in 2017, it was the latest then the census information existed, that there were 45 million foreign-born residents in the US. When they asked the question, were you born here or somewhere else, about 45 million. But 45% were already naturalized citizens, so about 50%. 27% all had lawful permanent residence. So 18% were undocumented. Undocumented declined in the last period, contrary to what some people would say. Immigration from Mexico has fallen at least half to less than half of the documented. So people are interested, is this all a Mexican issue because there are borders and they're coming over? As we've heard about we're being inundated and all of those things. It's actually gone down and it's less than half of who the undocumented are. Since 2010, the illegal entry has shifted from border crossings to visas, overstaying the visas. So the whole question about the border and the wall and that sort of thing, it raises to question when in 2016, 62% of the undocumented overstayed their visas, 38% came illegally. So a wall isn't going to deal anything with the undocumented. Those who overstayed their visa. Two-thirds of the undocumented have been in the U.S. for 10 years or longer. So we're talking about long stay, and there are people in communities, there are people who are paying taxes, there are people who are integrated into the community. All right. I'll go straight to the next assertion, having only a few minutes. The ethics and morality of a system that is being put in place deserves to be understood and judged by both the immediate consequences and the likely long-term impacts. Every government since Carter and long before has tried to deal with immigrants by illegal immigration by all sorts of means. Every government has tried to do that. It's still the question is, and I think the ethical question for us to consider is what's the ethics of how people are being treated. So for example, they have put in place different kinds of systems to try to dissuade people from coming. And we've seen this in refugee camps. In refugee camps they call it humane deterrent. In political speak, it's the opposite. It's inhumane deterrence. And it's the philosophy, if we make it bad enough, they will go home or they won't come. Is it true? No. It doesn't work like that because the drivers, people needing sanctuary and food and so forth, are greater than the risk. And let me just tell you one story with that. And that is, for example, I spoke with a maid just weeks ago who was in North Africa, in Tunisia. She had come from another country. And she said, I'm going to go to Libya. I'm going to try to get to Europe by crossing the Mediterranean. And my daughter said to her, you're crazy. I knew the case in Libya. You will be raped repeatedly. You will be detained. All these things. And when you get to the Mediterranean, you have a good chance of losing your life. She said, I know those risks, but I have nothing to live for. because of where I came from, the war, my father and family were killed, and I have not, even if I die, it's better that I take the chance. How are you going to stop that? That is, that's the kind of drives that are driving people. So anyway, the question is, I want to come back to the ethics. To me, the question with regard to many of the things that are being done right now, even in Harrisonburg, have to do with the ethics of how people are treated. So that kind of is the conclusion that I came to for my own self too, is that we may or may not be able to stop deportation, we may or may not be able to stop various of these big policy things. We should speak to them, I do believe, but we may not be able to stop them. But the one thing we should fight for is how the people are treated, that they're treated with dignity, that they're treated with respect. And the question is, and this raises, you know, this whole thing of the long and short term, the systems that are being put in place now to me are extremely worrying. Is that, you know, the new systems of the way people are, can be picked up. What, for example, I mean, the jail, the roundups, because of time we can't go into these, but there are so many of these things that we should think that they are not simply independent actions against immigrants. We're putting in place systems that these, if the immigration, if the crossing of the border is actually going down, as indeed it is, why then are you building billions of dollars of walls and, more than that, improving the jails here in Harrisonburg and building detention centers in Michigan and in Syracuse, New York, and in all along the coast, now 100 miles in, ICE has the jurisdiction. Today, the bad people are, by their standards, the immigrants. I feel very concerned that, and the ethical issue raises to me lots of when I think about this. In Germany, if you were living in a town and they came in the night and took the family, the response, many reports are saying, yeah, we noticed that. We saw something happening, but we don't know, but something happened, yeah. How much like that is the practice today of picking up people, setting blockades at 7-Elevens, laundromats, minor infractions of the law, like a light out, and the mother is taken, or the father is taken? And you said, yeah, but they're illegal. What does that mean? And if we had time, we would explore that. Laws are made by people. We make value judgments about these things. There are good laws. There are unethical laws. There are evil laws. I don't know which it is. I'm not suggesting that. But I'm suggesting that we, as Harrisonburg residents, as citizens of the Virginia and of the U.S., we should be thinking about these things, and we should speak about them from a moral point of view. I'll stop there. I have another 3 hours discussion in my last page, but I think that's enough for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Everett, for stimulating our thoughts. We have two responders, and if you notice on the program that you have the names, I'll make brief introductions to both of them, about both of them. First will be Jason Showalter. Jason went to school at Goshen and received a bachelor's in English in TESOL, and then later a master's in religion from Eastern Mennonite Seminary. For the past prior 10 years, he was involved in a mission service project in North Africa under a mission agency, and moved back to Harrisonburg maybe 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I'm going to guess. And he is now the new director of global ministries with VMM. So he will be the first responder. Following him, Lizette Hernandez. Lizette comes to us from Honduras. She received a medical degree there, medical doctor, came to the States. Among the many other things that she's done is received in Master of Divinity from Eastern Mennonite Seminary. She's married with two adult children, and I understand she's a soccer fan, a ferocious soccer fan, and enjoys cooking. Her current occupation is being the Latino Ministries coach at VMM. So we will hear both of these responders in that order.
Thank you to the Elder Exchange for your interest in wrestling with this complicated topic. I always try to find examples as I look down the road, folks who are a few steps ahead of me, and tonight will be another one of those for me, seeing so many crowns of wisdom in one place, all gathered to wrestle with a difficult topic when you could have been doing something else tonight. I want to begin my reflections in a spirit of lament, and my spirit as I've listened to your thoughtful and heartfelt reflections, Everett, has echoed the lament of the prophet Isaiah, "Woe is me. I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips." This topic brings up a complicated web of feelings for me, and I think I want to give a bit of a window into where I stand as I listen to this presentation and reflect on it. Well, I just started a role with VM Missions. Until 2 weeks ago, I was working in the local school system in a program for newly arrived immigrant children. I've worked with immigrants for much of my life in education, including the migrant education program here in the Valley, later in Chicago Public Schools, in a setting where most of my students had recently arrived from Mexico, and many of them wrote journal entries about crossing the desert. I was interested in what you shared, Everett, about your support for Cambodian refugees, since my sister-in-law arrived in this country as a refugee fleeing Cambodia. Her single mother took with her four small children, and they risked their lives in search of a better life. They lived for years in refugee camps in Southeast Asia and finally made their way to California. So I thank you on behalf of my family for the work that you have done to care for and express hope to people fleeing difficult situations. I'm also humbled at the fact that I and many of my extended family have benefited from the forced displacement of people. While one of my ancestors arrived as an indentured servant to this country, others were some of the first European immigrants to the northwest corner of Ohio following the Indian Removal Act in 1836. And some of these people had fled violence and the confiscation of their property in the Alsace region of France, and yet they found a place of safety and prosperity in a new land, on land that had less than 10 years earlier been the home of the Potawatomi tribe. I grew up in Goshen, Indiana, with names in the surrounding area like Shipshawana, Mishawaka, Napanee, all reminiscent of those peoples who had lived on that land. Goshen, a place of respite from famine for refugees. The children of Israel found a place of rest for a time there. And that leads me to, every one of your points about asking better questions, Christian questions. And one of the part that of his presentation that we didn't see tonight that I especially gravitated to was a short video clip from Pastor John Garland from San Antonio and his effort to ask and distinguish between what he calls political questions and Christian questions. And I appreciate that our Christian faith has political implications. I understand that. But I think at the heart of many of our disagreements are that we are asking different questions. We need to find a way to flip the script and ask the right questions, anchored in the gospel and in the life of Jesus, faithful witness of Scripture, asking questions that root us in that vision of God's shalom for the world rather than the truisms that often guide our questions in the West related to security and comfort. And I would say those have become idols for the church in the West. Another piece of my family's history is that a year and a half ago, we were expelled from a country where we had lived for 10 years, where three of my children were born. And as Everett noted, it was very different. I went through that process as from a position of some degree of control. I was returning to a place of security. But that experience deepened my appreciation for the support of the church in that time, impressed on me the need for the church to be reaching out as Christ's hands and feet in times of upheaval, of loss, and that we can be voices of hope in those times when people have been unsettled beyond their control. Let's be a part of asking those better questions that root us in the hope of the good news. Amen.
Good night. Thank you for the invitation. This subject touches me deeply. I am a Honduran, and it's been very painful for me the last year watching waves and waves of people from my country fleeing, running away, and searching for a place to have a better life. And it's just so painful. Even though I came to this country as a very privileged immigrant, I came here legally. I am here with some education, and I know the language, so my position here is extremely privileged as an immigrant. But I work with immigrants, and I worship with mostly undocumented immigrants. And that has shaped all whatever I believed before, the stories, the walking with them, the struggles have shaped my understanding now. I'm sorry. And now the issue has faces and stories and struggles. And that makes a difference. And I have the privilege of worshiping with immigrants, but also I am the coordinator of an institute for theology for our Latino leaders. So I sit with a group of 12 or 13 Latino immigrants living in this country to learn theology and to learn about the scriptures. And we wrestle with a lot of ethical questions when we go to the scriptures about their identity, their duties as Christians. And we have very interesting conversations in that kind of settings. So once you interact with the people, your perspective changes. And one of the things that I wanted to add today is that there is a spiritual aspect in migration as well. Movement of people is not an accident. We see that in the scripture. Not only the economic, social, or environmental reasons are behind migration, but it's God's hand. And God's hand through migration has been very obvious in scriptures. And now we can see that today, now. And as someone who lives in this community, I can tell you that God is in the midst of all of this. And even in the broken stories, I can see God moving in that people. Migration is a very difficult choice when you can make the choice. And it's a very, very difficult thing to do. Even when you have everything in your favor like me, it's very difficult. Not to mention when you have to do it forced. And one of the things that migrants have in common is they have a lack of decent options. And generally, they are forced to choose between the bad and the worse. And generally, they have to choose migration as being the less harmful decision. And whether they stay and get killed or starve, or they go through the desert and come to another country. So the lack of choices is something that you don't understand until you have to deal with that. You don't know how lucky you are to have the choices that you have. And self-examination, I agree that is very difficult. We all have blind spots, and that's why we need one another, and we need this kind of conversations. But as Christians, we have the advantage that we have scripture, but we have the Holy Spirit. I think Psalm 139 says, "Search me, God, and know my heart." We need the help of the Holy Spirit, even to self-examine ourselves. We cannot do that by ourselves, but we have that help. And also, I will agree that our morality is rooted in, it should be rooted in the great commandment to love God and to love one another. And but we can't also emphasize by biblical principles without being holistic. We can't emphasize and use like Romans 13 as a guiding principle to be submitted to authorities without using Romans 12. That talks about loving one another and being hospitable and carrying each other's burdens and mourn with those who mourn and associate with the lowly. So if we cannot hold the basic principles together in our system and in our churches and in our walking, then we don't have a Christian response. So we need to hold them together. We were discussing with my students, we were talking about Joseph and the story of Joseph. And we were talking about how this Pharaoh saw in this immigrant something as an opportunity. He saw that that Joseph was wise and he was discerning, and he used him for the benefit of the country. And he saw him as an opportunity. And then we were talking about the next Pharaoh, who saw the people multiplying, and he did not know of Joseph and his family. And they saw, and he saw these people as a threat. And he imposed more labor, and his response was different. He responded with oppression and killing the males, if you remember the story. So two different responses to immigrants in their midst. One saw the blessing they could be. They saw an opportunity to work with them. And the other one saw a threat. And so that presented our students a picture and a reality that we're seeing now. And that was our class conclusion. And I'm grateful that we wrestle with these things. And I just want to end saying what I heard from, I read from, I think it's one of the presidents of Ashbury Theological Seminary. He said that immigrant population actually represents the greatest hope of Christian renewal in America. And I think immigrants bring a fresh, passionate faith. Immigrant churches are growing and thriving and are multiplying. And that can be an opportunity and not a threat. And so I'm grateful for being part of this community, and I'm grateful as well for places like this where immigrants have a voice. I think you talked about information and misinformation. And I think what is lacking is the voice of immigrants, their stories, their voices. And you will find they have their same dreams. They have the same desires that you have. And I'm glad for these opportunities. And it's a privilege for me to talk on behalf of that community, because I feel very humble to be part of that, because I feel so privileged. Let me tell you, so it's a privilege for me to be here. Thank you.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay, we have almost 20 minutes, not quite. What are your questions? If you have questions, please indicate and I'll bring the mic to you. Please say who you are. We're doing audio of this, and it's nice to know who's asking the question. I'll kind of start over here. If there are any questions, then I'll move across. Might just make a comment. When you ask the question, you can address it to the panel or any particular person in the panel.
My name is J. Mark Frederick, Jr. The data we received today, and you put some up here about the migration and how many, you know, where did that come from? And how much are we bombarded by fake kinds of data? And how do you distinguish some of that?
Looks like it's yours, Everett.
Yeah, I really appreciate the point, and one of the points that I didn't, assertions that I didn't get to be made, is exactly that. Part of the difficulty in understanding what the ethical issues, the right things are to do, are because of this tremendous amount of misinformation. When I was preparing the presentation and was reviewing data, I found this website that was by an immigration center, and it looked very academic and credible. And I put the information down. And then I said, I wonder who these people are. And I went and looked at the looked it up. And it turns out that they are a center that has an extreme far right understanding and is putting out the information specifically to support their point. In the end, I found other sites which said, it's complete nonsense. That is. So the problem is a tremendous problem for all of us. And I think what it means is when we are trying to get information about this, we do have to look carefully at the sources now more than ever before. and see if we can find credible ones that is less biased, that is, that we think is more authoritative. Some of this information reportedly came from the Census Bureau, so I hope that's credible. But your point is exactly right.
Okay.
I don't know how to frame this as a question, so I'll just make a comment.
Who are you?
Vernon Jancy. What your response, Everett, is, I think, absolutely correct, in that we can look at places like the Census Bureau and the UN and other places like that, but even that has its own bias. When you're looking for information and data and so forth, make sure that you consult three or four different sources and get some general idea of the variation among those sources. That's probably one of the best ways that we can begin to deal with this multiple sources of information, and each source is designed to support what that particular organization is about. So compare lots of different sources and then sort of shoot for a happy medium.
Sounds like an educator.
Not only that, but a sociologist.
Oh, yes. Double whammy. Other questions, comments?
John Asa Hertzler. I was just thinking, suppose I get my head on straight about the morality and the ethics of the issue, then as a practical matter, what can I do? I listened to a lot of debates, political debates recently. I don't hear much about immigration there right now. It's not hot in the political field. But I hear a little bit about Sanctuary City, and Harrisonburg is, and some of the congregations here has worked a little bit on Sanctuary City, but I still am a little bit lost in what I as an individual can do.
Maybe we'll spread that across the panel. If you have a response.
Well, I will invite you to engage with immigrants and hear their stories firsthand. You will hear things that you may not read in any other place. And I will invite you to come to where they are. And sometimes you have to get out of your comfort zone and just engage with them and to hear their stories and the pull and push factors. Why are they here? And I think that's a very, very educational experience.
Everett mentioned the learning tour that MCC does, and I'll just make a note that VM Missions is in partnership with MCC to plan a learning tour for this fall to explore some of these things along the border. That's one possibility.
When we were down on the border, we met this really dynamic priest lawyer. And he said, many people call down here and say, what can I do? What can I do to help? He said, you should do whatever you can. And I thought that's really fundamental. And that is, when you look around, I was going to tell you the story. When we went on the trip, almost every program we saw came from one person who saw one thing that they didn't think was right. Let me just say, what happened with this backpack program you heard from MCC and others and so forth, people helping at the bus stop. Somebody was going in the bus stop and saw a woman and a baby sitting there somehow in distress. And she said, can I help you? And the woman was fearful and she went away. And then she wasn't satisfied. And she came back and she sat down on the floor and she said, can I help you? And she learned that the woman was there with a baby and she didn't know where she was going and she didn't speak English and she had nothing. And so this woman called around the city and said, is there a program for us? And they said, no, there's no such thing. So they started it. They started it locally to deal with people at the bus stop. And they had people going all the time, providing sandwiches, providing help to do it. If we were down in Brownsville and we heard the story of how this discovery of children being taken from their families was, the lawyer said, be a witness, go to the court, sit and listen. Why? Because it changes the behavior of the law, of the judge and the lawyers. And when they were there listening, a woman said at the end of the court, the judge's discussions with her, do you have any questions? And she said, yes, where's my child? And then she described how the child was taken away. And that's what started the whole question, to say, what's going on here? An outcry about that. So whatever you see, whether it's shelters, it's accompaniment, like the church in Tucson, the Mennonite church that has this accompaniment program, just, you know, be whatever it is, it started with one person saying, that's something I think I could do that would, you know, be a response to this problem. So, I mean, that's a general answer. And I would just say one more thing. What would I do? What I made thinking about this, and I made a list of the things that this explorations in all this would be for me. I can't, it's not what you will do, but what it's what I'm doing. So first of all, I really sensitize me, first point, to the people who might be migrants, to listen to them. As I said in the presentation, that was the advice. Second issue is to say, I really am committed to thinking we need to keep reading and looking at what's happening in these systems for one reason. I'm not a pessimist by nature in any way, but I think the worst is still to come. And so to me, what we need to do is to be aware. That's another thing we can do. Then within our own fields, we can do more. I intend to keep working on the issue of unaccompanied children and trying to convince, look at help agents be more strategic and fighting back. And most importantly for us, Elaine and Vernon and I, we've decided that we're going to try to get the STAR program from CJP, but modified so that it's for the migrant. Our goal, we're working to try to get that instigated into the migrant field. What we would love to see is that this program adjusted so it's specific to the migrant situation. We'd like to see it be with the border guard. We'd like to see it being with the children in the detention centers and the workers who, the lawyers who are working there. That's the kind of thing we're going to try to do. But everyone, I think, to go back to Mike, this guy, Mike's admonition, he said, do what you can.
Other questions? Well, I'm looking for questions. I'll go to Richard here in just a minute. Everett, share one story that you would have shared if you had more time before we get this question. A short one, like 3 minutes long or something.
Excuse me.
It does not take a long time to come here.
You know, of course, the first thing I think of are stories of migrants, their stories. But I want to just tell you one other one that for me is still really fundamental. And it's a book by Tolstoy. The title that I took for this lecture, What Should We Do Then?, is from the scriptures. And it's a title of a book by Tolstoy. And he describes his own personal journey of coming into Moscow, seeing a person in need, a street person, and saying, I wonder who they are and what their needs are. And that led him into saying, I think I can solve the problem of the poor. I'm going to create an NGO, a philanthropy. And then he learned that he couldn't solve the problems with a philanthropy. And that was the first quarter of the book. The rest of the book, three quarters of the book, is his beginning to look at why people were poor and why the person was in this situation. And he then began an analysis of the structure and of what the systems that were in Russia at that time, and of money and who owned the lands and his own holding of serfs. And he said, I can't do this. After he went through this process, he got rid of his own serfs. So that story is meaningful to me because it always starts with concern for an individual and helping, and we must never lose that. But if we pursue it, it always goes back to the justice, fairness, rightness of a system.
Okay. I'm not sure how to word this question, so I'll just see if you resonate or if I'm just off the wall. I believe rather strongly that borders themselves are very, very artificial. They are definitely not God-ordained. And I don't see anything in the scripture that defines that we need a border. And yet when I raise that in a Sunday school class or whatever, people look aghast at me like, or talk to me later and say, no, no, we got to protect our borders. Am I nuts or just too idealistic?
Start with Jason.
I would say you're asking a good question.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Nations will define their borders. Borders are about power and control, and to me it's the wrong question to be asking as followers of Jesus.
I think borders are porous for some and are hard for others. So it depends on who do you want to stop or not. They're just symbols that we use for our preferences. And I have an ability to cross the border, and my fellow Hondurans can't. And so the border for me has no big deal. So they're porous and selective. And I don't know if I'm answering or not.
Well, you're opening up, and I want to know, how do you feel when your relative cannot come, I think it's your relative, could not come back to the U.S., but you could go back and forth? Maybe it's not your relative.
Yeah, it is my relative.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So borders are in place
yeah.
for power. We know that we have power over here, but actually they allow some to come and some not to go. And so it's just a symbol that we use, I think.
What makes me think very much of researchers we talked with on our trip, Vernon and I, who documented, and we can refer you to the books, documented that we are just at the beginning of a wall building period, and that the model that's being used, and if you want to know what's coming in, to the best of my understanding, it's Gaza. The walls, the technology, the approach, the advisors are from Israel. The wall looks like the one in Gaza, and the cameras that now can see 7 miles and ground sensing equipment and all other things, the model we were told, the model is Gaza. To me, we have, it's a sad commentary. And let's just say, and what I was told is, oh no, walls are coming more and more. You haven't seen it, it's just the start. Not only here, they have conventions about walls now. They demonstrate all the equipment and how to do it. So we're not at the end of anything. And I don't know when we'll ever get through this, but we have a long way as humans, a long journey on this one. And when I ask the people on the border down, in Arizona, and I asked him, why are we like this? And what he said was, because good people haven't stood up. We haven't acted to, force the politicians to do the right things. So in the end, so I can't say whether borders are absolutely, it's just not in the concept of human organization presently to have without no borders. But porosity, as you said, how porous, and what I ask the people on the border, well, how many do you think, what's the limit? What should we open the border and let everybody in? Anybody who wants to come can go, or should we close the border? What's the right answer? And the persons who have faith down there said, I don't know. But they said, it should be kind. It should be kinder than it is. It should be more sensitive to the human nature, to humans, than it is. So that's not an answer to an absolute answer. Those are the reflections.
Thank you, Everett and panel, for the time and effort that you had and made in coming here. Let's give them a round of applause. And thanks to the rest of you for coming. God bless you. And we have on the table, if you don't have them, the flyers for next time and also an extended schedule. You're invited to take some of those along, pass them out to your unbelieving neighbors or friends who didn't show up this time, and maybe next time they will. And God bless you as you go. Good night. Yeah.